Hello, I'm Michael Watson, and this is the Influence Watch podcast. Journalism is changing, with nonprofit outlets, especially on the left, playing an increasing role in how information gets to the people. Just this week, the press has praised State's Newsroom, Arabella Advisors' seeded network of DEI-focused state-level journalism outlets, and a senior editor at the government and big philanthropy-funded National Public Radio published an article detailing how the outlet shifted from orthodox liberal in outlook to a radical vanguardist everything leftism with a commitment to esoteric identity politics. Soon, Capital Research Center will publish a special issue of our magazine focusing on nonprofit journalism and other ideological media projects. Joining me to discuss that are my colleagues Ken Braun and Parker Thayer. Ken, Parker, welcome back.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So I guess we'll start with the news. With this big story that dropped in Barry Weiss's The Free Press do you guys know the gentleman's name, the NPR guy's name?
I don't recall off the top of my head, but it was enlightening to say that.
So senior editor at National Public Radio, who was detailing its shift in ideology from sort of the conventional liberalism that most people think of when they hear NPR to the very fringe radical identity politics stuff. Do you guys have any reaction to that?
I haven't read the thing yet. I do have a subscription to Barry Weiss's very interesting publication. But I saw a snippet from it where the gentleman apparently revealed that, in an effort to increase their audience amongst Hispanic Latino listeners, in this case, they increased the number of stories on those groups and apparently found out that they had only managed to impress white listeners, that the Hispanic Latino folks really, I guess, know enough about their own culture that they don't have to listen to National People's Radio to find out more.
Sorry, Uri Berliner is the guy's name, for the record.
Gotcha.
Parker, were you able to
let me see it? One of the most the part everyone is focusing in on from the article, I think it's worth discussing, is the coverage of the Hunter Biden laptop story that they discussed. This article, for those of you who might not have read it, it explains that the NPR newsroom, essentially when the Hunter Biden story emerged and even after it was validated, the entire newsroom came together seemingly spontaneously and decided that this was not newsworthy and that they would not cover it, specifically for the reason that it would be a, quote, distraction and that it would help opponents of Joe Biden, namely Donald Trump. I think it's pretty revealing that with the news, with mainstream news outlets functioning like this, and NPR is one of those nonprofit news outlets, though it's not really considered one by most people. If this is able to happen at a publicly funded nonprofit newsroom, one can only imagine what will be going on in the, like, State's Newsroom that you talked about. I mean, how
I have to, of course, bring up the labor angle that Berliner mentioned. So apparently they're under SAG-AFTRA, which is the
studio union.
It's best known as the Actors Union in Hollywood, but it's also radio broadcasters, and apparently they have DEI at the union's urging written into their contract, and there's like a DEI panel that determines, that consults on their coverage, that's part of the collective bargaining agreement. Like, I try often to remind people that organized labor is just a front for the broader left. And there it is in the text, in testimony.
It does, you know, seems odd that a union of folks who was founded on folks who make, you know, magic fantasies come true in Hollywood is representing what should be news, hard, objective, factual representations, but maybe it's appropriate on second look that that's what they're doing. And, you know, it's funny.
Somewhere former SAG president Ronald Reagan is standing in his grave.
Or you know, laughing, I told you so, or something. Maybe it'd be interesting to look into who brought NPR under that umbrella. And it's funny, I'm trying to popularize the phrase regime media instead of corporate media, because to identify the folks that just do the stenographer work of the three letter agencies and you know, Dr. Fauci and whoever, not really doing objective, challenging journalism, but just repeating whatever warnings and fears are coming from the government. But NPR literally is regime media. It's like I need a special category.
While we're talking three letters, how about DEI in States Newsroom? So our outside Influence Watch writers keep sending me, you know, these profiles of all these States Newsroom outlets. And they all harp on, many as they are finished, you can, of course, find them at influencewatch.org. And they keep finding these States Newsrooms are all committed to this centralized DEI policy that, again, dictates their government.
And it's funny because I don't mean to hog the spotlight from you here, Parker, but just real quickly, the States Newsrooms are supposed to be created, at least if you read their objective language, to pick up the slack for where a local news doesn't go. Well, if you're just doing the DEI coverage, you're really not doing local news. You're inserting an agenda, a propaganda agenda in, and you're still leaving that space on.
And of course, in reality, that's the point. I mean, why else would Arabella Advisors have created this?
Well, yeah, but I don't think, if my local trash hauling contract is falling down on the job, or my lights are going off because the government monopoly power company is not doing its job. I want to know, the physics of the problem, not the the color of the people doing it or what their sexual preferences are or any, completely irrelevant things to me in any sense, but particularly when I, can't get the lights to go on.
Yeah. And I mean, this is just more proof that as DEI, as it manifests in education, the corporate environment, and in the newsroom, in each place that it has been seen, kind of in a domineering sense, everywhere it shows up, it is always about control. It's not about increasing diversity. In the universities, it's used to limit the viewpoints of conservatives.
So, and I'm gonna build off that, because I wrote about that in the magazine article that DEI focus and identity group publications, like publications that are supposed to focus on women, on LGBT people, on insert ethnic group here, that it's for the big philanthropies that are funding a lot of this stuff. It's an ideological filtering tool and a way to get control, because even the liberals who run your usual metropolitan press that constitute what Ken calls the regime media, you still have a bunch of old guys who are, they're liberals, but they're like, they're old union guys, or they're, their dad was a carpenter kind of people. They're not people who have been ideologically formed in the blast furnace of big philanthropy and of the MacArthur Foundation, about which more to come. And they may descend, like Mr. Berliner, from the new wave, ultra ideological focus of the contemporary newsroom.
Talk to any media people and they will, when was journalism great? Well, they'll point to, an era somewhere between skepticism of the Vietnam War and the end of Watergate, when big stories were broken and government was exposed doing all sorts, just on a regular basis, lots of government secrets and bad doing and whatnot were exposed. But prior to that, the media was mostly in the tank for the government. And after that, it was mostly in the tank for the government. So the glory days we're talking about here is, maybe a 10, 12 year period. And it's interesting that though the people breaking those big stories back then were, as you say, Mike, the you know, ink under the fingernails guys who probably didn't have journalism degrees. And the in a lot of cases, they were, you know, hard scrabble, you know, local reporters who could write and had a skeptical frame of mind. I think
guys who knew and studied a beat over years and willing in many ways. I mean, I'm thinking of a guy from a little bit before Ken, the time Ken's talking about, more in the 50s, Victor Riesel, who was was on the labor beat in New York City, and some organized crime goons who may or may not have been connected to Jimmy Hoffa, they blinded him. And he suffered for his craft. He was one of those guys who was trying to help organize labor be clean for the good of the workers at, you know, in his position on the labor beat. He ended up being a source for the Rackets Committee that led to the Landor Griffin Act. But, you know, today, you know, it's kids fresh out of college who are writing commentary about how, what was the Salon piece the other day? That there was a Salon piece by Amanda Marcotte that just was distilled off.
Yeah, and that is what you're getting at, is there all of the people that came rushed into, and I think that gentleman you just described, that era was building up to what was a generally good era of news coverage. It began with people like that in the 50s and such. I mean, after, you know, World War II, suppression of news was you know what it was. But after the seven, you know, journalism degrees, journalism departments are the blast furnace you've described for all of what wrecks media now. I mean, if I were starting a publication, I mean, I don't have a journalism degree. I've run a small news publication. I mean, you got to have some curiosity about the world, and I just don't think journalism is that. Yeah.
The distilled Amanda Marcotte headline is, "Men punching random women in New York City, what a perfect symbol of the male rage fueling MAGA." That was the headline that had come to
New York City is famously MAGA country. And like, building off what you said earlier, I mean, nowadays we've got journalists blinding themselves. Perhaps one of the worst examples of journalism I've seen
over
the past several years is related to what we're talking about today. A few days ago, a Politico reporter by the name of Heidi, Polish last name,
Przybyla.
Yeah, I blame the Polish. Anyway, she tweeted out an article about the state's newsroom network, written by another journalistic outlet. So we're at a journalist.
I think wasn't it Columbia Journalism Review?
Yes,
that being Columbia University, which is currently being investigated for anti-Semitism.
Yeah, that one. So we've got a journalist tweeting an article from a school about journalism, about a journalist nonprofit network constructed by Arabelle Advisors. And it just so happens that Heidi, the journalist who tweeted this bad journalism inception chain, is the one who Arabelle Advisors feeds their tax forms to earlier than everyone else. So she writes softball coverage about Arabelle all the time, which of course spawned the newsroom network that was being written about by the journalist school that she was tweeting as a journalist.
I think
journalism all the way down.
I think it was A.M. Rosenthal who said this, the New York Times publisher. You know, back in this glory era, he said, and I'll clean this up for our family audience. He said, if you're going to cover the circus, don't romance the elephants. And that's pretty much all of what we call journalism today.
Yeah. So, I mean, it the most damning thing you can say about the rising trend towards nonprofit journalism is that current for-profit journalists think that it's great.
That's,
I mean, there is no more sure sign that absolutely nothing of value will be produced by these new left-leaning nonprofit journalism outlets than the commendations of current journalists.
And Parker, you really need to put for-profit in some really hefty air quotes. I think a lot of media today is nonprofit, not by design, but.
Well, and I mean, we've seen that just from the, what I like to call the encodening or the great learn to code
in
the pogrom of journalists being laid off en masse across the entire country.
And it's interesting. We began this discussing Barry Weiss and obviously a refugee from the supposedly for-profit journalism endeavor, a couple of them.
And there was a labor angle in that, too, because the News Guild was, you know, let's just say not opposed and potentially reportedly, assisting the language of the people who are going after Weiss's opinion section because they published a piece by a United States senator on how to deal with Ryan.
Mm-hmm. And she is now in a very aggressively for-profit sector and apparently profiting pretty well on Substack, as are Matt Taibbi, basically everybody that was willing to cover the Hunter Biden laptop, the Twitter files, all of the very hard news exposing the bad news media of the last 4 years or so are all, they have paying subscribers who are paying for their content in a completely untouchable, non-advertising driven media sector that I wonder might actually, because right now, and this is in the report that we are coming out with, and at least the portion of it that I did, Substack gives you like 80% of your revenue that you receive. Substack only keeps about, 10, and then taxes get taken out. So if you think about that, their subscriptions are like $5 to $10 a month, depending on who you subscribe to. Someone could become a local journalist and have 2,000 subscribers at $60 a year. That's $120,000 for only 2,000 readers. And you could cover your local stuff as you want to cover it, and you're answerable only to your local readers. And I mean, that's an interesting model that could, since State's Newsroom is only covering the DEI aspects of every community that doesn't give a rip about these things, that
it's not just the DEI, it's also the local news, but with a DEI focus.
That's what I mean, looking at it through that lens. If I want my local news to know, if I want to really know what's happening in my local municipality, why my lights aren't going on, whatever, in any reasonable sized community, there's a space to open up a local news outlet that answers only to that community and would be a for-profit model that I think that might, there's a potential future of journalism there that is just embryonic right now. And the Barry Weisses of the world are showing how to do it nationally, but it doesn't have to be national.
What it is, it's a competing view of, it's a directly competing view of journalism to the nonprofit newsroom that's so popular on the left. And the reason, the main difference between the two, again, goes back to that element of control. The nonprofit newsroom is bought, literally bought and paid for by donors.
So here's it. So since you mentioned bought and paid for by donors, the Press Forward Initiative, I know we discussed that on a previous previous episode of the podcast. I think we had our boss, Scott Walter, on to talk about it. That is a $500 million project by the MacArthur Foundation, a slew of left-wing foundations that is just pumping money into local news companies. Again, they say it's not ideological. It's just that all the funders happen to be ideals.
Yeah, is that the one that's placing reporters in existing newsrooms? Or
I don't know if they're placing reporters. I just know that they're. I think funding was the first and foremost thing.
Yeah, they're so. The left's mega donors, seeing the collapse of journalism and not recognizing that the realize for the collapse was a lack of trust and a lack of coverage of things that people actually care about, and also just the uniform ideological.
People can get their box scores online now. So but, I don't need to buy the liberal commentary page in my local newspaper just so that I can read the box scores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they've seen the collapse of the model that worked for so long and assumed that nothing can replace it. That these journalists are irreplaceable. And indeed, the journalists write a great deal saying that they are irreplaceable. But the fact is that, just like Ken mentioned, this Substack model, the smaller private journalism model, has been there the whole time. It's just not something the left is willing to consider because they cannot control the newsroom. If they can't control it, they don't think it's powerful because they only value centralized control. They don't value the truth. They value creating narrative.
Yeah, I think there's also a kind of a path dependency going on there as well. Okay, so the old model's falling apart. Well, all we need to do now is just fund the new model, which will look exactly like the old model. We're just going to change the funding stream, and we're still going to have this top-down centralized media apparatus.
And then there's the question of control of distribution channels, because... Mm-hmm. You know, we've mentioned the New York Post, the suppressed New York Post story from 2020. You know, that only worked because there was, I don't know how you would say that the control was centralized. Like, was it a hive mind?
That's why I use the phrase regime media, because the regime writ large, in my thinking on it, I kind of think about it like the party in 1984, except in this case, the party, if you ever notice, if you read that book, the story doesn't really show that any one person is in charge of the party, but everybody just kind of knows, okay, this is the way to stay out of trouble. This is the way to get in good with the regime, whatnot. And that's kind of what happens here. You know that if you write the Hunter Biden laptop story and publish it, you're going to lose your sources that have been feeding you all of these stories that have made your life easier. You just kind of write down all of the supposed secrets that they're telling you. And if you go outside that network, you're going to have to actually do real work and wake up in the morning and try and find sources that are telling something outside of the parameters. That's hard.
Yeah, I mean, but in 2020, that suppression only worked because all the major distribution channels, with the exception of the New York Post itself and its corporate stablemates at News Corp and, you know, conservative ideological media, were all part of this hive mind. And now there is a very big chunk of the distribution channel, or I guess you'd say two very big chunks of this distribution channel that incidentally are at war with each other, in Elon Musk's Twitter X and Substack that aren't part of this hive mind, even if they happen to be fighting each other.
Exactly. So not part of it that they can't even, and they don't need to cooperate. I mean, this is what we would hope for, is journalism that hates each other and ruthlessly looks for an edge, which is not what happens now. The edge is to be inside of the tent and not upsetting the regime. It's an interesting sidelight about what the old school newspapers are. There is an old school newspaper that's just been created by Walter Kern, the novelist, called County Highway. I'm a subscriber. It you can't find it. They have a website so that you can subscribe to the print publication. It's a monthly newspaper, more or less for flyover country, is Walter's characterization of it. Here's what's happening in the middle part of the country. And you can, you know, there's a front page story on it about Charlie Kirk's Turning Point USA, one of their reporters who was very skeptical of the operation, went to their convention, and it's like, I don't know, 5,000 words on that. It's a deep dive actual story that I have to, you know, put on glasses for my failing eyes. Otherwise, I don't need reading glasses. And it's doing well. It's doing well. It's doing far. It's not even a year old, and he says they're way ahead of their current subscription goals. There's actually a hunger for independent, real thinking journalism out there. It's just not being done by the usual sources.
Well,
Parker, do you have any closing thoughts?
None particular. I think Ken closed up very nicely for us there.
All right. Well, thanks again to my colleagues Ken Braun and Parker Thayer for joining us. Keep your eyes on capitalresearch.org where you will be able to find, when it is published, the digital version of our magazine featuring nonprofits and journalism, which will be available free to readers. That's our show for this week. We encourage our listeners to subscribe on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And if you have subscribed, thank you, and please leave us a 5-star rating. Those ratings really help us find new listeners, especially if they come with a positive review. We'll see you all next week.